Hello, welcome to the Rubik's Mental Health and Wellness Podcast. We'll be talking with community members about how to live our most meaningful and fulfilling lives. For an overview of the Rubik's program, please listen to the introductory episode. Hi, and welcome back to the Rubik's Preventive Mental Health Podcast. We're going to continue to talk about emotional wellness for another episode here this month. So we're still talking with Dr. Marcia Gunsler-Stevens from the University of Maryland at College Park, and we're going to continue our deep conversation about emotional wellness and how to build habits for emotional wellness. We're going to circle back a little bit to talking about virtues and emotional wellness. And again, to maintain this thread from our first conversation, there's a book by Brené Brown called Dare to Lead. It's her newer book. And in there, she discusses virtues and how we enact those in our daily life. And Marcia, can you tell us a little bit more about what the discussion is there and how we can use that with young adults working on emotional wellness?
Sure. You know, one of the things Brené Brown has always been sort of known for is this idea about being vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have a place and a space and a group of people with whom you can be your whole authentic self? But she also goes a bit deeper in this book because she's really talking about people assuming leadership roles. And probably you're most vulnerable when you stand in the front and say, I have an idea. Here's where we might go. And so in some ways, she is building out one's sort of bag of tricks that includes things like, what do you value? And I love this quote where she says, when we have the courage to walk into our own story and own it, we get to write the ending. And when we don't own our stories of failure, setbacks, and hurt, they own us. You know, sort of that idea about how do you make meaning of the failure and the hurt and the ways in which you chose sort of a set of values, but they didn't work so well for you. The other is just what it is to brave trust. And so how do we gain a sense of attributes, virtues, ways of being that allow us to feel a bit more confident mm-hmm. as we enter into relationship with people, as we listen to ourselves? Mm-hmm. I think she's really sort of talking a lot about being willing to be engaged in one's own life as much as she is talking about how are you going to bring others along with you.
Mm-hmm. That's where you start, being engaged in your own
right.
life so you can bring
right.
others along. So what does she have people do with this investigation of virtues specifically? Because it's part of, in the book, it's sort of an investigation of your virtues and then you're supposed to do something with that,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And there are workshops that she does as
right,
well.
Right,
right. Yeah.
I'd take it out of her context
yeah.
and throw it into another context.
Mm-hmm.
So Milan Verveer and Kim Azzarelli wrote this book shortly after Lean In came in, because I think they were seeing it as somewhat of a follow-on. But in reality, there was some deeper meaning, and it was really about finding one's purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you assess what's already inside of you and sort of the meaning that you've made of all of that? But also, how do you listen to the voices of others?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the assignments I do with a group of students that all tend to be more seniors is I have them spend 2 weeks in reflection, writing down, what are your strengths, your gifts, your virtues, your attributes? Keep that list. The next day you have to refine it. Now you're going to cut it down to 10, but what do you think are the 10 most salient? Day 3, you're going to a group of friends, family members, or whatever that you trust to have them write the list about you as well.
Mm.
And sort of comparing those lists, right? So some level of it is to begin to understand what's already inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece of that assignment, which I think is kind of a cool thing, is to really think about the failures, the setbacks, the obstacles, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you've encountered. How did you make meaning of those?
Mm-hmm.
And then to really think about who's in your connections and how does that group of individuals or groups sort of inform your ability to both be resilient enough to deal with all of those setbacks and obstacles, but also where you might avail those virtues, those attributes, those
mm-hmm.
skills and talents to advantage them or the things you feel strongly about.
Mm-hmm. I could see using, there's a list of
virtues, right? And it's alphabetical.
Yeah.
And it starts with accountability, remember visually. And then, you know, there's dozens of them, and there's generosity, responsibility, forgiveness.
Right.
And I can see looking at a list like that and very intentionally identifying, okay, these are strengths of mine, and these are virtues I would like to build.
Sure.
And then very intentionally building habits that reflect that particular virtue into your daily life.
I just started a new class this spring, and I had a student in class say that every night before she goes to bed, she writes a list of goals for the next day. And then she writes a list of ways in which the world hasn't conspired and or she hasn't necessarily succeeded that day. A few things. And then she ends it with a few things for which she's grateful. Because she said, I want to go to bed happy. I want to go to bed in a positive tone. And I think about, back to Sheryl Sandberg, in her book Option B, she's just lost her husband. She's trying to figure out how do you get out of that malaise, that dark, dark period of life. And her therapist said to her, you know, get up in the morning and think, what is one thing you're grateful for? And the basic in her list early on was, I got up. Or I got dressed. Or I took a shower. Because in some ways, I don't think you have to have a really long list of virtues that you're fully great at all the time. But I think there are ways in which we can say to ourselves tomorrow, this is the one thing I'm going to work on. Or I've noticed lately that I've spent so much time being driven to succeed that I've forgotten to think about how far I've come, how grateful I am.
And then reconnecting with the vulnerability question again, I really like this metaphor of catching stones.
Oh,
could you talk about that a little
bit? Absolutely. So Bryan Stevenson wrote the book Just Mercy. The movie is out right now, which is a really amazing movie. I so admire the work he's doing with incarceration and wrongful, perhaps, incarceration for a number of folks. He says, and I am quoting Brian right now, I think there's another way of measuring how you're doing. He said, by how many stones you catch, by how often you actually position yourself to help those who need help. There's something redemptive, powerful, transformative about catching the stones that people throw at each other unfairly. We run from problems, most of us, but sometimes we have to run to the problems. You know, how are you going to position yourself because you're passionate about an issue to stand in front of what could be hurled insults or a really difficult circumstance that you put yourself in because you've joined the Peace Corps, or whatever it is that you choose to do? Or also, how do you speak out? And sometimes just speaking out is standing in front of a bunch of stones. Because to say that what your friend says isn't exactly accurate or is hurtful, well, you're standing in front of some stones.
And that ties together this whole idea of vulnerability building resiliency and adaptability, you know, where if you take that risk of catching that stone and then you realize that you did it and you're still standing up, and then you can not only have that strength yourself, but also provide it for the neighbor whose stone you might caught.
That's right.
And so I think that can tie up for us our conversation about that section. But then I want to move on to talking about Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom.
Book.
Yeah, very old. Two decades feels very
Isn't
old.
It? It's very old. Think about it. The book was written before most college students were alive.
Yes.
And I'm still using it, which is kind of intriguing because early on when you use the book, people would say, oh, yeah, I've already read this. Now no one's read it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, I use the book because Maury's in a transition. He's dying. And the students I'm encountering with that book together, they're in the middle of a transition. Theirs is this really positive, oh my God, you're going to college. But the kind of things Maury is looking back at the end of life, and he's doing it with his old student, right? Mitch Albom, the student who says to him at Brandeis, I'll always stay in touch. You're, you know, this transformative professor, which I also want students to get, you know, that being in a relationship with faculty is a good thing. But he doesn't stay in touch. And he only comes back into Maury's life when Maury starts to say, what are the lessons he's learning in dying that maybe have some meaning as an old college professor for the students, including those of every age out there. And so I think for college students to think about the fact that not all of life is how many pages you read for a history exam, but instead to think about some of those you know, back to those eulogy virtues. Mm-hmm. What will they say of Maury when he dies? And how is Maury making meaning of that for you? So, you know, one of the constructs Maury talks about is love, right? And the risk to do that, the risk to love oneself, particularly when, in his case, his body's failing, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. how do you seek the support of friends, even ask for it, mm-hmm. when you're vulnerable and weak? So the best example I can give you is this. My mom's had MS since I was 20. She's in a wheelchair. She's totally dependent on my father. I was with them one day, and my dad was helping my mom do all of her toileting and all the rest of it, and obviously needs to help her in every way. And I said, "Dad, I got this. Let me do this." And he said, "No, no, no." And he was very upbeat. He's always very upbeat about all of this. And he said, "Let me grab this." And he slides a mirror under the on the floor underneath where I could check to see if we'd done all the good work we needed to do to get mom ready to dress her. And I turned to my dad and I said to him, "Dad, if I ever forget what love looks like, that's what love looks like." In Maury's book, he talks about the asswipe test. Mm-hmm. When you're so dependent on another person that they have to, you know, help you toilet. Mm-hmm. I think about ways in which we become dependent on each other, sometimes in unhealthy ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't feel good about myself unless he, she says, "You're magnificent," or "You're beautiful," or I don't feel good about myself when I compare myself to others. But like, whether it's self-love or whether it's the love of one person, right, that sort of says to you, it's worth doing and being who you are. Mm-hmm. It sometimes edifies what we already know. Mm-hmm. Maury was willing to be dependent in some ways because he knew he still had a gift to give. Mm-hmm. And the gift was wisdom and eulogy virtues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you mentioned a little bit about that Mitch Albom had gone away from yeah. his teacher and then came back yeah. to him. And that to me brings up another emotional strength, which is forgiveness.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about how Maury exhibits forgiveness towards
sure.
his student to,
sure.
at the beginning of this?
You know, I think Mitch has gone away and crafted a career as a journalist in Detroit, and he comes back into Maury's life, and it's as if you have come home, and it was 2 minutes ago that we were in the middle of a conversation, right? But I think their relationship was always one of teacher-students, and so in some ways, this opportunity to be engaged in these conversations mm-hmm. Allows him to resume that role. But he kept saying to Mitch, "You were one of the good ones," right? He keeps reminding him that he was almost like waiting for him to mm-hmm. come back into his life. It was a gift for him to come back into his life. But I also think he knew that in some ways he needed to teach Mitch something that Mitch couldn't see yet. Mm-hmm. In Mitch's case, he's so busy with work, not unlike all of us, that he had forgotten to care for the people that loved him. A brother that was suffering, a wife that was doing magnificently in her singing career, right? But in some ways, Maury has an opportunity to shine the light for Mitch again, and in some ways embraces that opportunity without ever saying, "Where you been
mm-hmm.
the last, you know, 30 years of my life when you said you were going to stay in touch?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think about, you know, probably the best example of that are sometimes our grandparents mm-hmm. who are just so darn glad to see us in their aging mm-hmm. lives that they don't say, you know, "Oh, you didn't call me for 6 months."
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they say, "It's a gift to see you."
Yeah. So it's almost like the forgiveness isn't even a stone that yeah. has to be caught because it's yeah. already, it's just a given. It's sort yeah. of the attitude of openness and lovingness is just there so that the forgiveness doesn't yeah. even almost have to happen, it sounds
right.
like.
And in some ways, one of the things Maury is trying to teach Mitch is how to forgive himself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because you said these were the things you wanted to accomplish, or here's who you wanted to be when you grew up, and maybe you've gone a little south of that list, or maybe you've done all that stuff, but you realize in doing all of that, you forgot to take time for yourself or the people you love.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways to say, so how are you going to forgive yourself mm-hmm. as well?
Yeah. And so that also brings up the idea of acceptance, because it mm-hmm. sounds like Maury also really wants Mitch Albom to accept himself and the condition in which he finds
Absolutely.
Himself at that point
Absolutely.
In his life.
I was blessed to have had a student early, probably almost 15 years ago, that I taught in a class, the same class I taught your daughter in. And I felt like he was drunk every day he came to class. He smelled like it. And I was like, oh, Lord. And I couldn't seem to get to him. And I can get to most people. And I was failing in so many ways. And he, partway through the semester, indicated to me that he had just returned from the military, multiple deployments. He was a medic. So I'm like, oh, my God, gushing. I've got all these things I could do for you, right? He didn't want any of it. And I felt like he was one I didn't get to very well. Mm-hmm. Maybe 2 years later, I saw him on campus and we, you know, had a moment. And he said he had just found out he had failed out of school. I think he was hesitant to tell me because he felt like I would be sorely disappointed in him. I guess I walked away from that conversation feeling like I had made this happen. Like somehow or other, I had failed him.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 6 months, a year or two later, I see his email in my box and I write him a note that just says, what are you doing with your life? And write me a journal. And I didn't hear from him for a long time. And then I heard from him that he'd gone to community college and he'd taken some courses and he wanted my help getting back into Maryland. I think he would come back to Maryland. We did StoryCorps together. He graduated. He threw himself into supporting his peers. He talked about his own PTSD, about what it was to be really wrestling with failure as he saw it,
mm-hmm.
The need to forgive himself mm-hmm. for what he perceived to be the path he was supposed to take.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it was for me a chance for redemption as well,
mm-hmm.
to be in his life again, this time to see the conclusion differently,
mm-hmm.
To feel like I could affect his reentry into the university by trading favors,
mm-hmm.
And that in some ways he was this extraordinary role model for other people because he could talk about who he was because he felt confident enough and had forgiven himself enough to say that.
Mm.
I will always look back at that as a brilliant example of where we each had stake in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And his was probably more deep inside of his own head and heart. Mine was this innate sense that I can make everything all better.
Mm.
You know, mm. I'm the middle child of Midwestern parents. We're going to take care of everybody, right? I think sometimes one of our failures
mm-hmm.
is this belief that we can make it all better.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have to sit in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find and climb our way out of it and then look backwards and make meaning of it.
Mm-hmm. You do make it better, but not in the way that you thought you were going
to. Oh, not in
to.
The first way.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? The story has multiple endings.
Yeah.
I always love my colleague who used to be the director of the Counseling Center at the University of Maryland, Sharon Kirkland Gordon, used to say, when a student would come and say, I got an 80 on that test, I'm a failure, she would say, well, let's look at this. Really, you know, 80% of the material. So we only have to work on 20%, right? And so how do you almost say it's good enough for now?
Mm-hmm.
Or I know 80% of the material, so I really only have to do 20%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you pick up where you left off.
You
and
pick
keep
up where
going.
You left off. Uh-huh. And, you know, you're working your way to the end or the journey's end.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to start where you already were.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So something that strikes me every time I talk to you is that, well, you know a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you know a lot of people that have really joyful experiences. But it strikes me that you know a lot of folks that have suffered or are suffering have experienced a lot of loss. And as I'm sure is very apparent in our conversation here, you are yourself very, very upbeat.
Yeah.
And it's very authentic.
Sure.
And so I want to ask you, this is kind of a difficult question. I want to hear from you a little bit about how you yourself maintain that upbeatness, knowing all of this suffering mm-hmm. and also supporting and frankly solving a mm-hmm. lot of it. I mean, you really are somebody that wants to solve problems for people and that has solved a lot of problems for people. And there are some heavy stories mm-hmm. that you carry around. And I want to know what strategies you yourself use to maintain this upbeatness.
That's a great one. Couple different ones. One is, I'm informed by who I am, right? I'm a bit of an optimist. So that's going to carry you a little bit down the road. I am my mother's daughter, right? 20 years of watching my mother struggle to get up the steps, then not be able to get up the steps at all, right? But she was a teacher and, you know, still is in many respects a teacher. And she's the voice I hear in my head where she's like, oh, my gosh, we're going to do something magnificent today, right? This ability to see the possibilities, even when the possibilities seem limited by whatever, mm-hmm. your intellect. I also think about that idea of permanence. Like, do you believe that this is going to linger forever? My grandfather used to always say, this too shall pass, right? Mm-hmm. And he would say it after you broke up with someone, you know, and your heart was crushing and you thought, I'll never get over this. And he would say, this too shall pass. And you'd be like, oh, that's crazy. But then you realize, you know, and maybe it's looking back a little bit in life and you realize how many times we've been at this really rough part of the road and you get through it. And mm-hmm. and maybe that is resilience, that you feel like I've got some gifts and talents. There are days sometimes when I get in the car and I'm listening to NPR and I'm hearing all the news, the crushing news of, you know, hunger and all. And I try to think, you know, what did I do today that in some way made it better for a person? That because I can't measure how am I going to affect climate change or world hunger, right? But for that day, you know, students' food insecurity, I helped them get to whatever. Or like there's some component piece of that. Mm-hmm. There are the days where you enter and you have to like sing Broadway songs, right? Because you need just to totally shut it out. I'm reminded often about how I seek counsel from friends, from professionals, but I also seek counsel from really wise souls that aren't alive anymore, that write great books or who, you know, I knew at one point, I save greeting cards and I always have them in my calendar. I have a calendar still, which is crazy because I want to be able to go back and see what part of that journey I was on that was really, ugh, you know, the death of a friend. Where did that end up a year hence, 2 years hence? What am I able to take away from that? I start every day by writing a card to somebody. It's a really expensive habit. And I think sometimes the act of reaching out to somebody else for whatever, you know, either joy or real sadness, that act of reaching out also allows you to begin to heal. Because most of the time you can't control what's coming to you, but you can control who you're reaching out to. So I think that's intriguing. I also know that one of the joys of being in a place for 37 years is I can seek help with you.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, part of the joy of even being in these really difficult stories is that perhaps I've known someone who's similarly struggled and know where we can find the help.
Mm-hmm.
Or I know that I've seen people get to the other side of this and that maybe you can too at your own pace, in your own way,
mm-hmm.
but that we can do this.
Mm-hmm. Do you have flow activities that you lose yourself in to kind of recover from those at all?
Oh, kind of. All right. This is going to sound really bad. You said earlier in the earlier episode about Saturday Night Live, I totally love comedy. I'm with your relative. I will watch, you know, comedy, even really crass comedy,
uh-huh.
in an effort to just laugh.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I listen to Wait, Don't Tell Me and uh-huh. crazy news quizzes that are very, very funny, you know, that people make fun of what is really heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm not a person who dances,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I walk in the morning. And when I'm walking in the morning, sometimes I'm talking to myself because it's really dark,
oh, yeah.
and no one knows.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm singing to myself.
Uh-huh.
And I think if someone were to have a camera on you, like this idea about just moving and singing child songs
yeah.
in your head that give you the rhythm of the walk is really kind of a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece I would say is I don't go a day that I don't, you know, travel home and I call my mother and dad. And there's something about, you know, sort of checking in and hearing about life. But I also know there'll come a time when I call and they won't be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a student asked me, whose voice is in your head? Their voice is in my head, you know, because they're very intrigued by what you're doing and who you're engaged with and how those folks are doing. And they're both educators. So it's an extension of their own ability to be engaged in life.
Mm-hmm. And you have a pretty strong spiritual yeah. life as well.
Yeah.
Does that buttress your emotional life?
Totally. Yeah. So I belong to the National Cathedral in Washington. There's nothing more beautiful as an edifice than that. But I go in there in some ways to get my battery recharged.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my meditations always is that I know it's extraordinary that I've been unconditionally loved since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody gets that.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was given that as a gift early on, so how am I going to take that love and use it to advantage others or to help people understand that until you can love yourself, I'm here to love you? So I think just that quiet time, that time of someone talking at you in a way that fills your soul, can be quite extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. You go to the National Cathedral in Washington, which is huge, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Are there ways that organization builds community
yeah.
outside? So tell me about that.
That's a great thing to ask. You know, in some ways it is a community serving Greater Washington, D.C., right? Maybe that's their cathedral scholars, which are high school students who aspire to do something magnificent. Maybe it's, you know, outreach they have in the community related to, you know, hunger or poverty or ways in which maybe it's reading groups, right? That it's this way in which you share in common a book that you've read and your perceptions of that. I also think the act of being in the space with people, right? That the ritualistic acts that you take on being in the space with people, which is why I often think virtual reality is not it, right? Just to simply sit next to someone. I struck up a conversation a couple weeks ago with someone and literally didn't know her. But by the end, we're like, oh, no, me too, right? And I think that act of just bumping into each other, but also looking about and realizing there are others similarly coming that are wounded or need to have their batteries refueled or that are, you know, filled with joy, or whatever. I think that's a kind of cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and maybe this is me, I also think physical space has the way of giving you a moment removed, particularly green space. I just did a session a couple years ago at Cornell where we were talking about green space. Clearly, I was talking about a garden we have crafted at Maryland. But I was there and did this program with a faculty member from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, right? And they had crafted a garden that had just been opened prior to the shooting, and then how critical that green space had been in the aftermath of the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Being in spaces that give you a sense of hope.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's under the covers in your bed, but often it's large spaces with other people, ritualistic things we do, green space,
mm-hmm.
space you call your own.
Mm-hmm. So let's summarize really quickly because we've had a really powerful conversation. Let's talk about, list for me, strategies for resilience.
Sure. So Greg Eales, if he's using his saves, social connections, your attitude, right? Do you believe that we'll get through this or it's not going to stick with your permanent record?
Mm-hmm.
Values, knowing them, embracing them, seeking to find those eulogy values.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional acceptance. How do you accept yourself? How do you turn to another person and say, I love you, even if right now I don't like you?
Mm-hmm.
And then that sense of silliness and humor, how important that is to just live through life that way.
I think those are really great strategies. And then I would add on your students' strategy of what worked, what didn't,
yeah.
and what I'm going to do tomorrow.
Yeah, because you got to get up and do it again.
Yeah, and that in and of itself reflects optimism.
That's right.
And so I feel like those are some very concrete things we can take away from this
yeah.
conversation that can really strengthen everybody's emotional wellness and that we can keep track of, because
yep.
I love to keep track of things,
yep.
And that we can build into our daily lives as habits. And I really, I love the idea of walking and singing, even if you don't, when you don't, especially.
You never know what it's going to be.
Especially when you don't have an audience, if you're me. So.
That's so great.
Thank you for spending your morning with me. This has been really wonderful, and I think it's going to be really helpful for everyone that listens.
thanks everybody for listening. And I wanted to remember all of our listeners to make sure that you do that thing where you like the podcast and you leave a review and you share it with everyone that you think it could be helpful for. And additionally, please do spread the word about Dragon Digital Radio in particular. It's a really great community resource. There's a lot of really interesting shows, and mine is only one of dozens. So thanks for listening. Spread the word and like and review us, please. Thanks. Thank you so much for listening to the Rubik's Mental Health and Wellness Podcast. We'll return next month for more strategic conversation about how to live our most meaningful and fulfilling lives.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.